dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Every school child is taught that the majority rules. The truth is really quite different. A small oligarchy rules. Since the majority of people don't act in concert, well-organized minorities frequently prevail in determining the direction of society, whether for good or ill. Of the 100 largest economies, 51 of them are corporations, which are owned by and act for the benefit of less than 1% of the population. What options and actions are open to the rest of us, given that our electoral process has failed to give us real choices, and our nominally democratic government is in thrall to corporate power? What should we do and how should we do it? In the first hour of the program, we'll hear two speakers on the subject of mass protest. In our second hour, we'll address workers' rights from factories in China to farms in Oregon. Albert is the editor of Z Magazine, a monthly journal that covers news from an anti-capitalist perspective.
My topic was why dissent and with what logic? Why protest? Why demonstrate? And with what logic? Well, the reason we dissent is obviously in considerable part because there are things that we don't like that are going on. Let me just enumerate a few of those, hopefully not being redundant. When Arthur started, he said that globalization was, in some conceptual sense, rearranging, not increasing interactivity or interconnectivity, but rearranging the relationships that exist globally to affect power relations. Well, in 1980, CEOs in the United States earned what 42 factory workers earned. By 1989, CEOs earned what 122 factory workers earned. And as of 1996, they earned what 209 factory workers earned. That is to say, one CEO earned what 209 factory workers earned. That's a trajectory of change which isn't only affected by, but is a manifestation of the kinds of power differentials and changes that Arthur was talking about. In 1987, which is the most recent year I have some data for, there were 32.5 million people in the United States who lived below the poverty level. One out of every 10 white people, one out of every 3 blacks, and comparable for Latinos and Native Americans. At the other end of the spectrum, if you were to earn $200,000 a day, 5 days a week, that's $1 million a week, it would take you 2,000 years to earn as much as Bill Gates now has in his wealth. The only problem is you wouldn't catch up, because Bill Gates would have been earning 200 times as much each week in interest. In the Upper East Side of New York, there are households, we now go down from capitalists to lawyers, doctors, engineers, high-level professionals. The average household income in the Upper East Side of New York is $300,000. If you go 1 mile north into East Harlem, the average family income is $6,000, 1/50. In the United States, there is one successful suicide every 20 minutes, and at the same 20 minutes, there are 9 unsuccessful attempts. There are about 3 million homeless people in the United States. There are also 49,000 hotels in the United States. Those hotels are able to house 15 million people. They are generally half full. So at any given moment, there are 3 million homeless people and 7 million empty hotel rooms. In the United States, education, for the most part, teaches people to do what? To endure boredom and to take orders. You remember education, public school education. You look at the clock but you don't get up and leave, right? You're enduring boredom. Clearly, you have to take orders. If you don't take orders, that's clearly much worse than if you get a bad grade. If you get a bad grade, nothing happens. If you don't obey orders, you get expelled. In the United States, there are 250 reported rapes daily. There's probably 10 times that number. I suspect more than 10 times that number that go unreported. In the U.S., the black infant mortality rate is twice that of whites. Not to mention that in many black communities in the United States, you're living in essentially armed and militarized regions. In the Dominican Republic, people earn a few dollars a day, roughly 50 cents an hour, so that U.S. multinationals can properly profit. If they dissent, they are dealt with by local police forces who are trained in the United States in how to defend the system that remits that profit to the United States. Approximately 50,000 children die daily of starvation and preventable diseases worldwide. These are things that can cause a rational, humane person to feel like maybe I should try to do something about what's wrong in the world, or so it seems to me. Try to understand, if the black infant mortality rate is twice that of the whites, that means one out of every two black babies that died is essentially murdered, right? Because it's a preventable death. If 50,000 people a day die of starvation, and that starvation is preventable with readjustments of institutional relations, then all those deaths are murder. They're not murder the way shooting somebody is murder, but they're institutional murder. So it seems to me that that's more than enough reason, and the reasons that other speakers have given, and the reasons that any of you can enumerate without much difficulty with just a little time given to it, to be thinking about the possibility of dissenting. But there are a lot of things that cause pain. Aging is not really fun, I've begun to notice. It's not the best thing in captivity, but suppose somebody gave a speech and enumerated all of the pains and aches and eventual deaths that aging causes and said, let's go out and organize against aging. It wouldn't make much sense. And that's the way a lot of people feel when we say, let's organize against poverty, against racism, against sexism. Let's organize against these vast disparities of wealth and power. They feel like you might as well be talking about organizing against gravity or aging. Because there is no such thing as organizing against these things. It's the way things are. Well, what's the logic of dissent and demonstration? Suppose you live in a community and there's a street corner and there's no stoplight at this street corner and there's a lot of accidents and you want to get a stoplight. What do you do? Well, it's possible that you have a local agency that's in charge of that that's rational. So it's conceivable, perhaps, that you could just make a rational case in this instance. But let's say you don't. Let's say you have a local agency that has a set of interests that override any rational calculation of the number of accidents. What then would you do? Well, you would try to raise the social cost for the people who make the decision about the stoplight. You would try to create a condition in which the people who make that decision will decide to put the stoplight in, because if they don't, the stuff that you're doing is causing them so much aggravation, so much pain, so much loss of things they care about, that they will make that change. Raising the social cost is the logic of dissent and of demonstrations and of protest. What we are doing, it seems to me, if we are being strategic about our efforts, is we are trying to create a condition in which whatever it is we want, those in position to move the levers of power and make it happen will do so rather than endure more of our dissent. It's pretty clear that that's what it is. It isn't rocket science. It's not that difficult. So suppose we want to stop a war. Now it's a lot bigger than a stoplight. And I want to make something very clear. The rationality argument, the argument that people are dying, is not going to do us any good. Why is that? Maybe we should make that clear. During the war in Vietnam, the United States dropped plastic toys that hung in trees. They were small bombs. They were designed like mines to blow up. Kids would grab them and they would blow up. The purpose of these things wasn't to kill the child, right? That wasn't effective enough. It was to maim them with the shrapnel from the explosion. The reason they were plastic is because it was harder to find the plastic. So it would burden the infrastructure of Vietnam to try and deal with the ailments. Now, if you think about that for a little time, we don't have enough time to pause and stop and think about it. The mentality that came up with that is not a mentality that will respond to the argument, you are hurting people in Vietnam. All we are telling them is that they are doing what they are trying to do. So that mentality doesn't work. Just like going to General Motors and telling them, wait, your policies are not benefiting your employees. They are benefiting you. That will not work. Thus, what you have to do is raise social costs. You don't argue rationally with this. You argue rationally with the public, but you don't argue rationally with the elites, which are benefiting from the practices that you want changed. You pressure them. You force them. So you raise social costs, whether it be a stoplight or a war. What doesn't raise social costs is, you know, an argument designed to convince them that they're wrong. Let me give another example of that. This is an important point because while it's understood in this context, it often slips out of people's grasp. So, for instance, there are a lot of people during the Nicaragua-Contra wars would say, go to your congresspeople, go to various elites, and explain to them that their policies are pushing Nicaragua into the hands of the Soviet Union. Make a rational argument to them that they are acting contrary to their own interests. Well, the problem with this little approach is that the congresspeople and the elites in this country are not morons. And if we can see something like that, they can see it too. And so it must be instead that the policy is designed to have the impact that it has. So in other words, the embargo on Nicaragua, which pushes Nicaragua into the hands of the Soviet Union as a trading partner, does what? It allows the rationalization that we have to go in and destroy the Nicaraguan attempt to actually control their own lives because they are an emissary of the great Soviet monster in Texas and they're going to come over the border. In other words, for instance, there are people in the media world of activism who say, well, we have to explain to the New York Times that their coverage is incomplete or inadequate or misleading. The New York Times prints all the news that's fit to print. That's what they say. Doesn't that tell you? The New York Times prints all the news that's fit to print. Fit by whose standards? By their standards. When you go to the New York Times and tell them that their stories are jaundiced, are biased, are incomplete, you're saying to them, you are doing a good job. You're not convincing them to do a job differently. So instead, you have to raise social costs for these institutions if we're going to implement them. The IMF, as described, the World Bank, the WTO, these are not stoplights. These are large, powerful, important institutions to capital, to the people who run society and who benefit from it. So what is it that we can do that is going to change their view of their calculation, if you want, their cost-benefit analysis, to use their terminology, of whether or not they should persist in their policies? If you go back, how many people know what the Pentagon Papers is? Oh, this is a pretty political crowd here. If you go back to the period when the Vietnam War was winding down, and you look in the New York Times newspaper sections, you'll see periodically so-and-so, a big famous lawyer or doctor or congressperson or a senator, will hold a press conference, and they will explain why it is that they all of a sudden have to change their view on the war. I supported the war, but now I must, in all good conscience, oppose the war. And what did they say? They never said, I must in all good conscience oppose the war because American GIs are dying. They never said, I must oppose the war because 100 times as many Vietnamese and Laotians and Cambodians are dying. They never said, I have to oppose the war because it is morally abhorrent and it is an invasion of Indochina. What they said was, our streets are in turmoil. We are losing the next generation. Meaning what? We are losing the value structure of the next generation, which is no longer interested in pursuing the old lines of approach and becoming a part of our system, but wants a different one. In other words, something even bigger, if it can be understood, even bigger than the war in Vietnam, was in danger. Their whole approach to life, the institutions which give them the power and wealth that they have, was under some attack. And the war was aggravating the threat to that. And so, one after another, they would say, look, I would really like to win this war. They would say that quietly under their breath. But I have to come out against it because the impact it's having on social movements is too dangerous. The threat is too great. That's what it means to raise the social cost. So let's ask, what actually does raise the social cost at that level? Suppose that a movement exists, whether it be about the war in Vietnam or what's going on in Colombia or the question of racism or, say, the IMF or the World Bank, or globalization. Suppose a movement exists which can send 50,000 people, or 100 or 200,000 people, I don't really care, to Washington every other month for a demonstration. But there's no trajectory of change. Is that a threat? Does that raise social costs? No. Once it plateaus, it's nothing. All it is a cleanup task the next day. Now suppose that a movement is going to Washington and is sending more and more people. Suppose that a movement goes to Washington and instead of 200,000 people, there's 100,000 people, but there's 5,000 people doing civil disobedience. And the next times it goes, there's 150,000 and 10,000. And then there's 220,000 and 18,000. And so what's the message? The message is the longer these policies persist, the more people become aroused, the more people become committed, the more people through that process become so committed that they're willing to break the law. Suppose that the demands begin to broaden out so that it's perfectly clear that what's at stake is what? We're losing the next generation, or we're losing the current generation, or we're losing middle-aged people, or the working class. Suppose that happens. That is a threat. This is a very important kind of concept. It is very simple, but it matters a lot. It concerns me greatly, for example, that if you look from Seattle to now, for all the celebration, if you look from Seattle through Washington and L.A. and Philly, you don't see growing numbers of participants in the demonstrations. That's not a threat. I'm sorry. It's disruptive. It's got costs. It's putting things on the table. But it is not a growing threat that is going to be sufficient to overcome and get rid of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it about what we're doing? Is it that the civil disobedience? No, because that's an integral component of a movement that's going to be threatening. I don't know the answer to this question, but I think that a good part of the problem is that we are losing track a little bit of the fact that we need not just increasingly militant, increasingly aroused, increasingly aware small numbers of people, but instead growing numbers of people. And that we need mechanisms that reach out to those growing numbers and that say to them, there is something that you can do other than traveling 1,000 miles to a demonstration, being ready to endure gas and clubs, and on top of it, perhaps lose your job because you miss work, and have no kids left because you have no place to put them when you come there. Somebody once told me a story about the Intifada, you know, in Israel, the Palestinian movement, which was exceptionally powerful and moving and rich and broad and involved a huge section of the Palestinian populace, all kinds of people, old people, young people, really young people, newly parents with their kids, et cetera, doing civil disobedience. And it went on and on. It was having tremendous impact. But over time, there began to be a frustration. And the people in the age bracket of, 20 to 30 began to get angrier and angrier, totally understandably. And they turned toward more and more aggressive tactics. And after a while, the tone of the demonstrations changed in such a way that those broader constituencies could no longer come. Somehow, we have to find a way to retain the civil disobedience, which is the cutting edge of our dissent, which communicates the trajectory that is threatening, and yet attract more people, ever-growing numbers of people. Because without ever-growing numbers of people, it's not an ongoing threat. Why is the fact that very few people are interested in whether Marion Jones wins a race tonight a problem? Recently, I spoke at the University of Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh, the place where Joe Paterno is the football coach. What's the name of the university? Penn State, in College Park in Pennsylvania, the conference. I spoke to a few hundred people. I asked a very similar question in College Park. Is that the name? Capital City in Pennsylvania. It is? Okay. There's a stadium and there's a city. The city, small city, has about 40,000 as its population. The stadium houses about 60,000 people. Every weekend the stadium is full. This tells you something about what's going on in this city. I asked the audience of about 300 students, these are organizers, on a campus with 20,000, 30,000 students, how many had been to a football game? One football game in their university. Four or five hands went up, all black. Nobody else had been to a single football game. I asked how many people had been into one of the sports bars in the vicinity of the campus to try and organize their fellow students. No one. In fact, they found the idea incredible. Right? They were so afraid of even conceiving of doing such a thing. This is a serious problem, I think. It is desirable that this set of people has become so courageous and so committed that it's willing to travel from the middle of Pittsburgh to Washington and demonstrate and get arrested and get clubbed and get gassed. That is not a bad thing. That is a very, very good thing. But it is undesirable that they have developed a kind of culture, if you will, and of community existence, which makes them a absolutely, almost from Mars on their campus. You can distinguish them at a snap, any member of it and everybody else on the campus. And their ability to communicate with the other people on the campus is horribly crippled by this. Now, if all we needed to do to end the IMF or to get rid of the disparities of income that I talked about was have a relatively small part of the population highly politicized and highly militant, it wouldn't be a problem. But that is not all we have to do. That is not all we have to do. Some people are in political activity because they want to be able to look at themselves in the mirror in the morning, basically. I think that's a valid reason. I think that should be part of our reason for wanting to do political activity, morally, personally. Some people are in it because they want to fight the good fight. They want to be on the side of justice. They want to be right. There's an element of that that should be a part of what we are doing also. But too few people, I think, are political and are socially involved and are activists because they want to win. And because they believe it is possible to win, and have that guide them and guide their thinking and guide their strategic work. That is what is necessary. Without that, it's hopeless. With that, it isn't just hopeful. It is possible. That's the step. That's what's needed. What's needed is to be strategic. When we are strategic, and when we come to realize what's necessary to make these changes, we behave differently. There was a demonstration during the war period. It was called May Day, for those of you old enough to remember. Tom Hayden, you may remember his name, Rennie Davis, go around the country, give speeches. Rennie Davis was probably the most eloquent speaker I ever heard. Tom Hayden was an eloquent speaker. They would go around and they would say to their audiences, come to Washington May 1st. We're going to shut down the city, stop the government, stop the war. And they would give these powerful, emotive talks, gut-wrenching. And people would go, and people would demonstrate shutting down the city, wild in the streets. And people would go home, and the government kept going, and the war kept going. Now, Hayden and Davis knew that the government would keep going, and the war would keep going. But they organized in such a way that when people went home and turned on the TV, they were deflated instead of empowered. Another thing that we have to understand is where we are and what we can hope to accomplish and not grasp defeat from the jaws of victory. Right? You go and you do a demonstration and you raise consciousness and you raise awareness and you increase the number of people and you look and you say the IMF isn't ended and you grab defeat from the jaws of victory. The victory is building a larger movement. The defeat is mistakenly thinking that you should have ended it in one day. So, do I have a little longer? 3 minutes? What I would ordinarily do is I would now ask the question, instead of just why dissent and what its logic, but why revolution and what its logic is. We don't have any time for that. So we'll just knock it off the agenda. No. So another time. But I would like to say one other thing that I think is in 30 years ago, when movements began, the women's movement began with women getting together and talking to each other and discovering that pains that they felt battering, just being ignored, having less income, working harder, being et cetera, et cetera. We're social. We're also endured by lots and lots and lots of other people, basically all other women. And we're social phenomena rather than private inadequacies. Michael Harrington wrote a book about poverty in which he basically did the same thing. It isn't as if nobody knew that they were poor people. Certainly poor people knew that there were poor people, right? But what people didn't somehow grok was that it was a social phenomena, a social problem, an institutional problem. The same thing happened with respect to race, and that was in the emergence of the civil rights movement. We can't replicate that, because I would argue that nowadays everybody knows that poverty and racism and sexism and disempowerment and alienation and all the other crap that people endure are social problems. No one thinks that it's, you know, everybody knows at some level that the whole damn thing is stacked. So you can't arouse people by enumerating all the things that are wrong. All you're doing when you do that is you're saying to people again, well, you're suffering and it's painful. But that doesn't arouse anything anymore because it's not, it's old news. So it seems to me that the obstacles to motion in the United States is not that people are happy. If people are happy, the TV wouldn't be full of advertisements selling things. You look at them. They're selling things by selling happiness. If everybody was happy, that wouldn't work. Everybody's miserable, and so selling happiness, those images of happiness in the ads, that works because everybody would like to be a little happier, a lot happier. The obstacle to progress in the United States, progress in building movements, is not that people are satisfied, not most constituencies, not when 1% owns the same as the bottom 95%. It's not that. It's that people don't believe there's an alternative, and people don't believe you can fight City Hall. Those are the two things. And what I would like to suggest is that the movement and the people who are centrally involved in setting the tone of movement discussions has just got to come to understand that we can't, that we have to move toward answering those two questions. What's the alternative? And by what's the alternative, I don't mean just what's the short-term alternative, because the populace is smart. The populace, whenever they hear a short-term alternative, says, yeah, but in the long term, the markets will swamp it. Private ownership will swamp it, right? It will go back to being exactly what it was before. So they want to know, what are these small, what are these short-term gains lean toward in the long term, which makes a whole institutional setting which allows people to live real lives. So we need a vision. And they also want to know, how do you organize and accumulate the power of our populace in such a way that it raises social costs to win those short campaigns in a trajectory of empowerment which eventually wins that vision? And those are the things that I think a good deal more time on the left should be devoted to. Thank you.
That was Michael Albert of Z Magazine speaking last fall in Boston. For more information on Z Magazine, you can find them on the net at www.zmag.org. For another look at protest, we turn to scholar and activist Ward Churchill, who addresses the issue of tactics of nonviolence. He spoke last January in Washington, D.C. about his essay, Pacifism as Pathology.
Ward Churchill is a veteran activist, organizer, and writer. He has served on the Governing Council of the American Indian Movement of Colorado since 1981. He's a former national spokesperson for the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. He was also involved in the campaign to free Geronimo Pratt and remains so with regard to other political prisoners like Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's a professor of ethnic studies and ethnic studies department at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and he's published over a dozen articles and co-authored and edited articles extensively on indigenous rights issues, political repression, and the politics of imprisonment, including A Little Matter of Genocide, A Holocaust Denial in the Americas, 1492 to the present, Fantasies of the Master Race, Literature, Cinema, and the Colonization of the American Indian. And of course, we're here today to talk about 1998's Pacifism as Pathology, published by Arbitering Press out of Winnipeg, Manitoba. This book, as most of you all probably know, has stirred up a lot of controversy and debate. And among my circle of people I work with, there are people I know who absolutely love the book and think it's brilliant, and I know people who think it's not so brilliant. And there have been many. I've been involved and been around many, many debates from people who consider themselves pacifists and those who consider themselves not so pacifists. So, would you please give a warm welcome to War Churchill?
CEO, Hosiju. Hello, my relatives. Even though it's abysmally early in the morning for me, good to see you here. This is billed as a workshop, so I'm going to try to make it at least somewhat such. Talking heads and workshops are not interchangeable parts in my mind. So what I think I'm going to do, on an assumption that not everybody has read the either brilliant or not so brilliant or whatever it is, actually 1984 essay recycled in 1988. It's seen a certain longevity in Xerox form as well as more formal published formats. I'll summarize that to a certain extent, get through with that as quickly as possible, just to sort of set the parameters of what it is that seems to be at issue. I'm not sure it's entirely what I intended to be at issue in writing the essay in the first place. And see where it goes in interaction with you. Well, I'm going to be making a few references to hierarchy and privilege and keying some response patterns to those concepts as we go along. So before I even start, I'd like you all to look around and see if you can see any kind of a common denominator here that's not necessarily reflective of the social demographic realities of North America or any place else I'm familiar with other than perhaps Boulder, Colorado. Which, as Tom Robb, head of the Arkansas Klan, put it when he came to speak in Boulder and was protested for opposing diversity, that he didn't know what the protesters were there for, because Boulder was exactly what it was the Klan was trying to create. Suggesting that if the people who were assembled in favor of diversity wanted diversity, they might consider moving to, say, Detroit. I notice the laughter has fallen off here now. Interesting thing. I won't go quite so far as Charlie Hill to say that maybe I should put my shades back on so I don't go snowblind, but there's a certain commentary being made there. Yeah. And I think you want to pay heed to that with some of the commentary that will probably come forth a bit later in the session here. It's spoken from a particular vantage point. It's spoken from a particular position of privilege, which in fact is reflected, no offense to the organizers, in the composition of the people attending the conference. You need to think long and hard about why that is. And understand before we even get started that I get very different response patterns in different contexts. And there's reasons for that, and I'm going to try to go to some of the reasons in a very abbreviated form here. But in approaching the essay, I made certain assumptions as well. And the assumptions began with the fact that what it is that we, and I'll make that as inclusive as it's possible to make it, that we, what it is that we oppose is something which is not an abstract, which is not some philosophical matter of inequity, imbalance, but rather a concrete reality that manifests itself in a way which, in a hierarchical fashion, depending on the place assigned by the elites of the social structure which prevails right now, is lethal. Is damaging. It has tangible human costs in terms of degradation, suffering, and death that is apportioned according to that particular position in the hierarchy. Everybody suffers it to a certain extent. The nature of that extent depends on the nature of the place that is assigned. All oppression, while oppression is oppression, all oppression is not equal. Some suffer it in greater degree. But the upshot of it is that those who suffer in the greatest degree do so by dying. We have an intrinsically violent context we oppose. Violence is an ubiquitous social reality. We can't make it go away by wishing it wasn't so. We can't make it go away by bearing moral witness to it. Power concedes nothing without struggle. The nature of the struggle is what's at issue. From there, took a moral position, if you will, which may be different than some of the moral positions that you understand yourselves to hold. My moral position is that the only thing which is moral is that which brings that structural reality to an end. You don't assess things by abstract external standards. You assess things if you engage that concrete reality on the basis of what works. If it works in the sense that it tangibly leads towards the dismantlement of the structure of intrinsic violence in which we all inhabit, the effects of which we all experience to varying degrees, you are taking a moral position. If you are acquiescing in any tangible way to the perpetuation of that struggle, you are taking an intrinsically immoral position, so much for morality. A little greater degree of concrete engagement now in analytical terms as to the natures of struggles that have been undertaken. I make the argument, and I'll put it out here in simplistic form because I'm sure we'll have a chance to chew on it when I'm done being the talking head, is that there has never been an entirely nonviolent or pacifistic social movement of any sort that has ever led to a concrete change structurally of any system of violence that I am aware of at any point in history. That includes Gandhi, that includes Martin Luther King, that includes any other movement of nonviolent engagement you wish to make, which is not to say that they haven't existed, which is not to say that they haven't had an effect, which is not to say that they haven't been a part of constructive transformation, but that's the key, they're part. And there's a logical conclusion that can be drawn from that, which is that we have a finite continuum of options available to us in a tactical or strategic sense by which we confront power. And that in a position of relative disempowerment to the structure which imposes the violence upon us, we concede nothing by way of options to that power. We are the relative disempowered body of people. We are attempting to effect change that leads to a relatively, well, I guess ideally, a total dissolution of social violence as our goal, our aspiration. In the process of pursuing that, we give up no options. We give up no options whatsoever. I offer an analysis of the Gandhian movement. I offer an analysis of King's movement, what the pragmatic and practical realities as opposed to the mythologies that attend those were. Why and what it was that rendered them relative effective. The juxtapositions between the various elements, the various options, and the deployment thereof. I do not, on the basis of that criticism of the mythology, make an advocacy for the primacy of armed struggle. I make argument to no primacy of any particular tactic at any point. Each situation is exactly that, situational. It's based on analysis what tactics will be most effective. You keep your options available and you apply tactics as most appropriate in any given moment. Maximum flexibility. We have very finite resources. We need to maximize the effectiveness of their impact. We need to win. There seems to be a misperception out there that if you make the proper moral, pure argument that somehow or another you're going to attract more people than if you made another kind of argument. Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people. People are not attracted to losing. They're not attracted to suffering for suffering's sake. Well, there probably are a few people out there who may fit that bill. But as a mass organizing strategy or as any other kind of an organizing strategy, unless you're into the local S&M club, it's probably not going to carry you very far. We need to pick goals, and we need to pick tactics, we need to calibrate the tactics to the goals, and we need to achieve those goals and show people that it's possible to win in the face of state power, and any means you use to effect that are appropriate means. The only inappropriate means are those that fail. It's not that anybody is genius enough to sit down and determine before the fact necessarily what it is that's going to work, but you learn from what it is that doesn't work and you alter your tactics. You pick different options based upon the experience in struggle of attempting to effect a particular change. On the other hand, we have an effervescent reality to deal with, which is the pretension of affecting a moral purity which is nonviolent in the face of endemic violence, in which we go through ritualized forms of bearing witness, through which we go through eternal petition campaigns, through which we go through all manner of symbolic protest rather than confrontation. And it can include confrontation of particular forms in which there is an active engagement with the forces of the state. And I use some anecdotes on that. I want to lay it out. One of the anecdotes for its reflective value. 1983, roughly, about a year before the essay was originally written, and this is what sparked the writing of the essay. It was solicited by a publication no longer exists called Issues in Radical Therapy. We'll get off into radical therapy a little later on too if you want, okay, but I'm not going to go into an excursus on it right now. They asked me to come and do a workshop at the annual RT conference, which was held just outside of Boone, Iowa, okay? And the name of the workshop was Demystification of the Assault Rifle. Yeah. And the idea, the premise of it was there was a disempowerment of self. There were a lot of people taking positions. This was the thesis that led into it. Why one of the conference organizers asked me to come and do this. There was people were intimidated by the technology. They knew nothing about it. They felt relatively ignorant. People they felt superior to knew lots about it. Therefore, they simply condemned it on moral basis out of ignorance and fear. And one way to deal with that was put them in touch with the technology, show them that it was something that they could possibly do, and then they could make an informed decision as to how they wanted to relate to it. But on the basis of ignorance, there was no possibility of an informed decision. There was just a visceral response, and that was considered not necessarily psychologically healthy behavior. So I did that. Took a Heckler and Koch 308 and a Heckler and Koch 223, which are the primary assault weapons available in a NATO arsenal. NATO round in the U.S. circumvention of the Geneva Convention, which is the 223 caliber. I can explain that technology a little later, too, if you want. I will not go into that. In any event, we sat down, and I showed actually a bunch of opponents who had shown up for that. They were the feminist collection. They thought this was somehow or another a phallic symbol and came to protest it on that basis, but got totally, as it turned out, immersed in the whole thing. Found it fascinating, sitting there disassembling, field stripping these rifles, putting them back together. We didn't go out and fire them. It wasn't a place to do that, but there was an open invitation for anyone who had participated in the workshop to come and do live fire exercise and get clear through to the end. Now you're conversant with the weaponry. They came back, gave excellent feedback in the workshop, said it was actually a rewarding experience. They would be better positioned to oppose the use of assault rifles, knowing how an assault rifle worked, than they had been before. It was not the outcome that I'd anticipated, but nonetheless, that was the point. They could make an informed decision as to how they related to this particular piece of hardware and the implications of it. And they weren't talking about it in terms of being a phallic symbol anymore. So at least, I guess, from my point of view, there was that particular gain made. This caused a crisis. This caused a major crisis. They had a plenary session after I left. Okay? There's another little incident that had occurred just before that which tempered the nature of the argument, but it came out this way anyway. And I'll go back to the little incident before I wrap up as well. At the plenary session, they passed a resolution by fairly thin majority, but majority nonetheless, that in the future there would be no weapons allowed for any reason at the annual RT conference. No weapons aloud at the annual RT conference. The guy who had asked me to present the workshop raised a question, the answer to which becomes instructive, at least in my view, and I suspect it may be in yours. The question he asked is, what if the police come out to the annual RT conference looking for someone or looking for something or just to let the people there know the police were still around? Are you going to disarm them? No. That's different. That's different. Yes, it is different. The police are the armed manifestation of order on the part of the state to which the nonviolent movement in the United States has historically acquiesced from day one. It's taken for granted. It's assumed to be normal and therefore in some weird way acceptable that the state will be armed. When we talk about opposition to weapons, we're talking about opposition to weapons among the opposition. And consequently, replicating and reinforcing through our own value structure this disparity of power that confronts us and thereby perpetuating the prerogative of the state to impose itself upon us. That's the theoretical. Make it a little more personal. One of the leaders of the charge in getting the proscription on the opposition having weapons at its own conference, as opposed to the police, shall go unnamed, but was a member of Claude Steiner's RT collective out in San Francisco. And Steiner was one of the heavy hitters in RT. Took a position, as it was put, a principled pacifism and a lifelong dedication to it. Had never lifted a finger in physical opposition, had sat down, and so forth, but in confrontation, so-called, with the state, had never lifted a finger in what might be, in any way at all, construed as a physically violent fashion. So right at the beginning of the smoking has effects worse than nerve gas campaign that's been affected in some cycles. Circles of society. Well, you got a guy also from the West Coast, black man, who had been asked to come and do a workshop, not with weapons, at the RT conference as well. And he's sitting off to the side of this open-air pavilion they're using as a meeting hall, smoking a cigarette, drinking a cup of coffee, and she marched herself over and she told him, put cigarette out. And I won't repeat what he told her. It was basically, take a hike. You don't like my cigarette, that's fine. Why don't you go 200 feet over to the other side of the building and leave me alone? In which case she told him, put cigarette out. In which case he ignored her. At which point she picked up an empty coffee cup and hit him in the head with it. Nonviolence. This caused major trauma. She's still doing crit self crit over this one, I suppose. Okay. But the nonviolence doesn't end up being necessarily so nonviolent in personal affairs, only in a formal construct of supposed opposition. And there's a problem with this contradiction that goes way beyond the personal anecdote, because I could spend the rest of the morning giving you more. And where it leads this particular weird, I would call it sick dynamic, is to Seattle, with people on our side of the barricades interposing themselves between people who thought they would break glass as a major statement. Now, I'm not going to go into an advocacy of breaking a window at Starbucks is going to bring the state crashing to its knees, okay? That's not my point. My point is that you got the people who are purporting to pacifism interposing themselves between corporate property and people who might inflict some tangible damage on it. And the cops, meanwhile, are standing as spectators, their job being done for them at no cost by the opposition movement. And there's something really wrong with this somehow. I don't know, ask your local police chief. And ask yourself materially what you're doing to put yourself between that baton and that baby's head. And that takes us to the next part, maybe the last part. And the last part is this: I have no quarrel with anybody's tactics, insofar as those tactics work. And I will always begin with the lowest level of confrontation and see if that works and follow the continuum. Armed struggle is a defensive posture first and foremost, and in terms of a good offense being the best defense, a court of last resort. The cut line, however, that divides pacifism from pathology, and that can be done, is the degree of personal commitment manifested in the ability and willingness to take risk, that is, to put yourself in harm's way. One does not question the courage of a committed pacifist like Norman. Oh my God, it's morning. No, it's not Norman Bates, okay. Now the Quaker who immolated himself in front of the Pentagon back in 67, and I just suddenly blocked on his name, and that's a cardinal disrespect, and I'll attribute that to mourning, okay? Norman Morrison, thank you very much. I'm not going to the Pentagon and immolate myself, trust me on that. I can question the effectiveness of the tactic, but I do not question the courage. I'm not calling pacifists cowards on their face. What I am saying is that there's a bunch of people whose position is tempered by a desire to remain relatively safe, privileged, but morally pure, who are claiming the name pacifist without being entitled to it, who do not risk, who will not risk, who coordinate their activities with the state in order to be able to take this position, apparently satisfying to them, of moral purity without incurring the concomitant risks that attend a genuine struggle for social transformation. And that's where the pathology enters in. You've got people out there who do this, who would never interpose themselves between the police baton and a baby's head in order to avoid violence because it would result in injury to them, who do so on a completely cynical basis. They do it in full knowledge. I suspect they're rather a minority. They're nonetheless there. More to the point, and this is where the pathology actually begins to enter in an endemic fashion, are people who have genuinely convinced themselves that somehow or another staying safe and privileged is a morally superior position, who will actually go out to the communities of color that suffer the sharp end brunt of state oppression to explain to them the moral temper of their posture that is most appropriate, that would critique people who are trying to defend their lives and their babies' heads, who are trying to have a future, who are trying in this moment to survive, go out and give workshops and give instruction and give moral sanctimony and then return home and make commentary, we are in solidarity with the EZLN. We are in solidarity with the Zapatistas. We are holding up our candles while they hold up their guns. Guns are inappropriate here. They would only be appropriate there. We are in solidarity with the National Liberation Front in Vietnam. We are in solidarity with the Sandinista fighters in the jungles of Nicaragua. We are in solidarity with the ANC in South Africa. We are in solidarity with every armed struggle on the planet except here. Now, how could that be, and how in the hell is holding up a candle while people die an act of solidarity? How is your moral witness so damned important? How is putting a bumper sticker "Free Tibet" on the back of your Volvo in Boulder bearing witness to anything at all? Because you go down and spend $4 at the Tibetan tea house that they turned into a recreational center as a sister city in Boulder. They even managed to turn that into a ritual of privilege. And in Tibet, without in any way diminishing the oppression and suffering of the Tibetan people, I'm sorry, it's no worse than that on a Pine Ridge Reservation, which is barely 400 miles from Boulder, where they could actually have a concrete effect. And when the case of Leonard Peltier is brought before the Boulder City Council in its solidarity with Tibet and say, could you make a statement suggesting that Bill Clinton might perhaps commute the sentence of a wrongfully committed American Indian freedom fighter, the answer is, we don't know enough about it. Yeah. That's pretty much the thrust of the book that's so controversial. There's the nature of the criticism. There's, of course, more to it than that.